For us to begin our Bible study period. Do you know how to stop that? Anyone know how to? I mean, I can stop it, but I don't know if you can start it again.
Press the B button.
B. I did B. It went away. No. What it's doing behind the scenes, I don't know. We're glad that you're here. We're going to pick up with 1 Samuel 18 in just a few moments. If you have announcements today, be sure and get those to me so that we can make them at the end of the next service. Let's have a word of prayer and then we'll begin our study. Our Father in heaven, as we approach you, we do so with gratitude in our hearts, mindful that you have blessed us with another day. We've enjoyed a night's rest. And Father, in a very special way, we have an opportunity this morning through our time together to be strengthened in our relationship with you. Help us, Father, each day to be mindful of your word, the truth contained therein, the principles, the truths, and the examples that can help us see how we need to live our lives. Help us to be honest in our studies and diligent in our efforts to apply. And above all things, Father, help us to study and read in such a way that our efforts are to glorify you. And we pray, Father, in our studies that we would be better equipped to help others understand your truth as well. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. I understand that what we need to do is answer the questions for chapter 17, and then we'll jump into chapter 18. And see if we can't manage that, and maybe even perhaps a better part of chapter 19 in our study this morning. Chapter 17, 1 Samuel. Do you have question sheets? Anyone that doesn't? As we look at the questions, the first one is, how many did Ahithophel suggest that he be allowed to take to pursue David? 12,000. How did Hushai counter the advice of Ahithophel? What did he suggest? I'm sorry? Bring all of Israel in. What was he doing? We're going to make a big show of this. This is going to be a big deal. We're not going to run out real quick, try to do something. We're going to get a lot of press out of this somehow or another. One of the things, even as we continue on into chapter 18, that it's probably helpful to remember, and I'm sure you looked at it in some detail last week, but we find in chapter 17 and verse 14, the latter part of this verse. Well, we'll read the whole thing. It says, Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Harchite is better than the advice of Ahithophel. For the Lord had purposed to defeat the good advice of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring disaster on Absalom. That's what's going on here. Even as Hushai brings his advice. Now, the thing, again, we have to remember, God didn't make him do it. God did not put him in a position where he had no choice but to do that. God does not work that way. But nevertheless, because of the advice and because of the heart of Absalom, it worked out that he said, I'm going to do this instead of this. And God knew that would happen. And God is going to use this because the thing we have to remember, you go back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, God has made some promises regarding David, the throne of David, and what will come after. And nothing will keep that from happening. God will use the circumstances to accomplish his purposes. We don't always understand it in the short run. When we look in the rearview mirror and we see the events as they unfold, we say, we see what was going on. And we need to understand that even today, God still does that. God still accomplishes His purposes with men. And we don't need to ignore that in our lives. It's a very basic truth regarding our faith in God. What message, number three, did Hushai send to David? Okay. And number four, who carried the message to David? Jonathan and Ahimaaz. What did Ahithophel do when he saw his counsel was not followed? Killed himself. Why did he do that? Saw the handwriting on the wall. He knew what was... We've talked a couple of times in our studies of this. When you ended up on the wrong side, as far as the king was concerned, what was going to happen? He was going to do away with you. So Ahithophel made his preparations and it says prepared his household, as it were, made his last decisions, and then he took his life. Where did David arrive according to verse 24? Question number six. Manahim. And essentially, if you're looking at the map and here's the Jordan, we're on this side. It's the east side of the Jordan. And you're up about kind of between, almost on the border of where Gad and Manasseh would be if you go back to that division of the land on that side of the river. Question seven, where did Absalom and his men encamp? Gilead. And that again was this area now that's on. It kind of encompasses some parts, it looks to me like, of what would have been Reuben's territory, some of Gad, and then maybe even reaches up into some of what would have been Manasseh as far as that tribe's inheritance was concerned. Question eight, what did some of David's supporters bring? Brought what he needed, didn't they? They brought the supplies, whether it was food, something to rest on. Three or four individuals identified as chapter 17 is coming to a close. Shobai, Rabbah, and Machir, and then Barzillai, who was a Gileadite. But these men were being loyal to David, and they understood what the needs were, and they made sure they had what they needed after fleeing from Jerusalem, after fleeing from Absalom, and needing some rest and needing some nourishment. Questions, thoughts you have on chapter 17 before we start looking at chapter 18? Okay, as chapter 18 begins, it says, David numbered the people who were with him, set captains of thousands and captains of hundreds over them. And he sent out one third of the people under the hand of Joab, one third under the hand of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, and Joab's brother, and one third under the hand of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I will surely go out with you myself. And how did the people respond to that? You won't. What did they tell him?
He's worth 10,000.
We need you back here. We don't need you up there in the front lines. We need you right here. And whether it was from a military standpoint to see where the weak points were and bring out reinforcements, but they were concerned, it seems to me, primarily for the safety of David. This is where we need you. We need to know you're okay. We'll take care of what's going on out there. And so the king agrees to that, and he sends the people out, as the text says in verse 4, by the hundreds and the thousands. But as he sends them out, what does he tell them? Be gentle with Absalom. Absalom, his son, in the midst of everything that's going on. And there's a lot of discussion and debate as to why David might feel this way and why all of these things have evolved in this manner. But fundamentally, be gentle with him. In other words, spare his life. You know, bring him back to me. And it's important that he notes that all the people heard what he said. All the people understood David's command. Now, I don't think in any respect that David had a voice that carried so much, that, but the word got out. And it filtered from this person to this person, from this leader to this leader, in regards to, here are the instructions of David, our king, regarding his son Absalom. All the people knew. Yes, sir.
Would you say this is consistent with David having a heart, the way that God made it, a man after my own heart, in terms of having an attitude like God treats us as badly as we have sinned? He wants what is best for us. Not trying to say that, you know, ignoring justice and any of that, but just that idea of David's.
I think one could try to draw that lesson. The one difficulty I have with looking at it from that perspective, if you didn't hear Greg, he was, what he asked was whether or not David's decision and choice here was reflective of God's attitude towards us, a man after God's own heart, in regards to mercy, in regards to grace, in regards to forgiveness. And I think some of that may be in. But I have to remember first, was there anything about Absalom that reflected anything even remotely close to penitence at this point? there was no sorrow on his part. And when you go back and try to think through it, you know, I mean, the same old questions we've talked about on several occasions, is David still feeling guilty because of what he did with Bathsheba and the example of the family and everything? The text doesn't really reveal that. I'm not sure that I can say definitely that's what it is. I'm not opposed to that, but I don't know that
I can say. God has loved us.
Sure.
And if God extends forgiveness, even if we're not repentant, we don't get the benefit of that forgiveness until we repent.
Sure.
But that God was ready.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's certainly a ready application, that David was ready to accept him back if he would be the kind of. Now again, we have to remember, as best we're able, the environment in which we find ourselves, because it's going to carry us forward to Joab's actions in all of this. And when a king was dealing with someone who was rising up against him in that day and time, what'd they do? You eliminate the threat. You get rid of it. And even as we think about some of the events here as it unfolds in this chapter, it seems to me one of the things that we have to balance out our perspective of David's approach with is, what do we think Absalom's attitude would have been had he caught David? Because I don't think there's any question what his outlook was. Sure. I mean, he's made it evident that he wants to be king. He spent a lot of time, even after David had already shown kindness towards him in manipulating circumstances to get himself in a position where the people would follow him and pull away from David. So I have little doubt in my mind what Absalom's attitude would have been had it been reversed. And he was sending people out. I don't think he was saying, be merciful. I don't think he was saying, be gentle with my father David. I think he was saying, get rid of him. We have to eliminate this, because at its core, Absalom had to understand that David was an entirely different kind of leader than he himself was. And he knew that ultimately, long term, if David were still there, the people would turn to him eventually, in my judgment. I know the text does not really address that, but as you look at the two different styles and the kind of respect that these individuals had, because Absalom was all about the pride, it was all about the ego, it was all about the position, it was all about the people completely looking to you for everything. David wanted them to be looking to God. That's how God describes him on so many occasions. Was he perfect at it? Absolutely not. We've seen that in so many ways already. And as has been suggested from our studies in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12 going forward, in my personal judgment, David struggled with that the rest of his life. But God also told him, it's going to be hard going forward. There will not be peace in your family. There are going to be difficulties. And I think he carried this burden that, even though he knew, as we've studied on several occasions, Psalm 32, Psalm 51, God has forgiven me. What a blessing to be forgiven by God. But nevertheless, you have some of those consequences that just keep raining in on you and reminding you how foolish you were to have gone down that path. So in that setting, I think all of these points are apt. But now David has sent them out. Be gentle with my son Absalom. And so the people go out in verse 6 to battle. And they say they're in the woods of Ephraim. And you're going to find a lot of discussion about whether they went back across the Jordan, went to the territory of Ephraim, and there were woods and rough ground. Or was it just some woods on the same side? It seems to me it's probably on the same side of the river they're already on. That's my opinion on it. I don't know that that impacts the text in my judgment. But there are some who feel that they crossed the river and the battle took place in the territory of Ephraim. I don't know of any way to prove that one way or the other. But there are both in Gilead and in Ephraim some geographical areas that are both woody and very rough and treacherous as far as travel is concerned. So battle in the woods of Ephraim, the people of Israel in verse 7 were overthrown there before the servants of David. A great slaughter of 20,000 took place that day. For the battle there was scattered over the face of the whole countryside, and the woods devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. And it's just the vegetation, the woods, the ground. I mean, it's been described by people who've looked at both sides of the river there. You're talking ravines, you're talking cliffs, you're talking thick, heavy vegetation. You know, in Kentucky we had sinkholes, you know. You know, just all of a sudden would open up, or one wasn't there the day before, and all of a sudden, boom, there it is, and it all had to do with the caves down underneath. But all of that to say, a lot of people died. The majority of them, the text is saying, died not because of the sword, but because of the woods and the terrain. And perhaps that ties back to God accomplishing his purpose. Because the whole point of this is to get Absalom out of the way. God is removing Absalom from power. And it may well be that the terrain had the most to do with that. Absalom met the servants of David. Absalom rode on a mule. The mule went under the thick boughs of a great terebinth tree, and his head was caught in the terebinth. He was left hanging between heaven and earth, and the mule which was under him went on. A picture we've seen painted for us since we were this tall going into a Bible class in regard as to what happened to Absalom on this occasion. Someone saw it. They come to Joab. Say, I saw him. He's hanging in a tree. And Joab says, and you just left him there like that? Did you not go ahead and finish him? What was the individual's response?
I had to
wait. His dad said, don't touch him. We're supposed to deal gently with him. And without hesitation, it seems to me, Joab says, I've got something I've got to do. And he just leaves. He grabs spears that are handy. He takes them with him. He finds Joab. And he takes his life. Now again, remember in the context, where's Joab coming from? This is what we do with people who oppose the king. I'm sorry? Yeah. Yeah. There can be a lot of other motives behind why Joab is doing this. As you look at family and things that Absalom has done down through the years, you know, as he got to his position amongst the people of Israel now, not the followers of David, at least not yet again. And it says there were men with him, and they just, the picture is they just kicked him and beat him and after he's dead. And then they threw him in a ravine, threw rocks on top of him. Very shameful death and burial.
Absalom had a long time to think about it.
Had not thought about that, but that's probably right. And suspect he knew what was coming. Suspect there was no doubt in his mind what was getting ready to happen. I don't know how many ways you can wrench your neck to try to get out of a vice-like grip like that. But that's the picture of how the woods were in that area. I mean, and I don't know if he was just galloping along on the mule, if he was just trotting along. He was trying to get somewhere, but just in his haste, he came up on this thicket, and all of a sudden, he was trapped, and he could not get free. Again, I don't discount the fact that God's doing something here. God is all, you know, we've already seen in the previous chapter, this is God's objective. Now, doesn't mean he's making, again, repeat, he's not making Joab do what he's going to do. He's not made Absalom behave the way he's behaved. But God said, it's time for this to come to a conclusion. It's time to move forward with my plan. And Absalom needs to be gone. And so whether or not that made it more difficult for Absalom to free, because it's hard for me to envision, though I won't deny they never had to cut them, but there were a couple times my head ended up between some banisters growing up that for whatever reason I couldn't get back out. And some folks had to kind of grease me up and twist and turn a little bit and listen to me squall. But at any rate, the idea that you get wedged so firmly and so tightly but you cannot move. And you hear something behind you and you're going, okay, what's that? But that's where we are. But, you know, good comments. Questions you have down through verse 18, the observation made that Absalom had made a monument to himself because his children had passed, and they threw that in there on top of him too. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was, it doesn't seem, of course, you know, reading and actually hearing what he said, he was playing fear. It's like, it doesn't matter how the outcome is going to be, all he said was that it's going to be out. Like, you got to go in there and win.
Yeah.
Perhaps, so, you know, perhaps that he knows. I have to be careful what I say.
Yeah. But at the same time, he knows what God has promised him. And he believes and trusts in that promise. What Wes is asking is, as he looks at the circumstances, it would serve. Now, the thing we remind ourselves of is he's gone from a few hundred people that left Jerusalem with him to now there are thousands as far as the soldiers are concerned. Companies of hundreds and thousands getting ready to go out and do battle. So that has grown as he's picked up followers. But Wes was wondering, or just making the observation that, you know, look at the confidence. Because David seems almost certain what the outcome is going to be. You be careful with Absalom. You be gentle with him. And maybe perhaps because he knew of Joab's demeanor. Yes, sir?
This is not the first time Joab has done something like this.
Oh, no. Well, and the thing we have to remember, too, as we think again about the environment of that day, and this is not till we get to chapter 19, but you think about it, well, once it's over, the dust has settled, and now David's getting himself established again, who's his general? It's not Joab. Someone else is going to take Joab's. You can't trust the man. He will not do what I tell him to do. And so all of this is kind of threading together as we see what's happening in the story. And, you know, at what level, as people, as we develop these attitudes within ourselves, and we're not careful to surrender our will to God and be what He would have us be, to what degree and how God goes about using that to accomplish His will is something difficult for us to see, particularly when we're not looking to God for guidance. But God assures us, and we see it again and again. Yeah, I mean, Jeremiah 18 just still, you know, rings in my mind consistently, even as we look about us in the world today. Here, go down to the potter's house. What do you see there, Jeremiah? And Jeremiah describes what went on with the clay and the potter and how the potter worked with it. And God said, just so you know, that's what I do with nations. I've been doing it, I'm doing it now, and I will continue to do it. And so in all of that setting, as we look at this and we think about our need to surrender to God, understand at one point, every knee will bow. And every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And God is supreme. He is sovereign. And He is worthy of our praise. And in the rearview mirror, some of us, as we think about the world in general, to destruction, and those who live lives of faith will live in heaven with God. But in the rearview mirror, He got His will done. And His will is that you and I glorify him in our lives. And there's a sense in which, because of the sharp contrast that exists, when we choose to go the wrong direction, when we choose to allow Satan to rule, when we choose to allow issues of pride and ego, even like we look at Absalom, you know, you got a contrast here. Who's God for and who's God against? And so that's a challenge for us as we look at our lives and think about what's going on here. As the chapter comes to it, we're around verse 19, but as the chapter unfolds, man comes up. Yes.
I think it's important to remember that Absalom and Joab are cousins.
Sure. Well put. Good observation. As we look at this chapter unfolding, word has to be gotten to David. And Ahimaaz comes up and let me take the news. Joab says, no, wait. Let's send, and he's going to pick a servant, a Cushite, an Ethiopian, who serves him as far as his needs are concerned, and let's send him. So they give him the message, he send him out, and then Ahimaaz just says, I want to go, let me go. And what was Joab's concern in sending Ahimaaz? I'm sorry. Okay, it may eventually come to that concern, because has David already done that a few times? Someone came and told him about Saul. You didn't have any business killing the Lord's anointed. They thought they would be rewarded. No, it's not what happened. So maybe that was part of the concern. But it also suggests, it seems to me, that he might have been concerned that if he saw Ahimaaz coming, well, this is going to be good news. This is why he sent him, someone so close to everything, because this is good news. In fact, Ahimaaz gets there first, and what's he telling? The battle's won. The battle's won. Then the Cushite comes, even though he left first. Ahimaaz got there before he did. And David finally says, Absalom. Okay, the battle's won. I understand that. Now what about Absalom? And what does the servant say? I wish all your enemies were like Absalom right now. And David just, as one would expect, falls apart. He grieves. And I really hate to stop this right here, because the next chapter is so vital, connected with it. Because in chapter 19, if you had a chance to read that, David is mourning, he's grieving. What's happening with the people? They don't know what to do. We went out, we fought this battle, we won, and David's just sitting there like he's totally lost. He has no purpose. He's not acknowledged or expressed appreciation for it. And there's some division starting to occur. And so Joab, again, at a certain level, now we have to remember, I mean, I more and more get the impression that he's kind of a political machine. He says, you can't do this. You're the king. You can't carry. These people went out and they risked their lives for you. They told you they wanted you to stay back here. They would go out and do the fighting. The battle's over. The battle's won. They defeated the enemy. Now you need to clean yourself up. And you need to get out there and you need to act like a king. Now that's not in any particular verse. But when you kind of summarize everything that has happened, that's what Joab is telling David. And I guess to some degree, you have to appreciate his willingness to go toe-to-toe and kind of jar the man a little bit, because the man needed jarring on occasion. I'm not saying that Joab's motives were always the best. Don't know that his methods were always the best. But he said, this is not how you need to handle this. And to some degree, he's saying, you knew this is how this was going to turn out. It had to turn out this way. Absalom's already shown that you can't trust him. You can't keep him around. Why are you grieving about this? As we suggested earlier, though it's just supposition, if the roles would have been reversed, there's very little question in our minds what Absalom would have done towards David. He's already shown himself. Why did David all of a sudden say, we've got to get out of Jerusalem? Because he knew what Absalom was going to do. We can't stay here. He's going to kill all of us. And so Joab is saying, David, what it looks like in verse 6 is that you love your enemies and you hate your friends. That's what it looks like, David. Now you go out there and you talk to these people and you let them know that you appreciate what they've done on your behalf. David realizes that's the case. He gets himself together. He goes out there and the people see him. And now the people are becoming more united again. And then as the chapter draws to a close, he's coming back to Jerusalem. He's on his way back. And a lot of discussion about who gets to help him come in first and who's going to escort him in and things like that going on. But fundamentally, as we see these events unfolding, Joab is saying this needs to be a celebration. This was a great victory. You are king again. And you're king over all of Israel. And we need to go back to Jerusalem in that very fashion. And of course, as the events unfold, we see in verse 13 that David says to Amasa, you're going to be my commander now, not Joab. You're the one that will lead my armies going forward. And then it talks about the different individuals. The individual that comes all upset because you remember when David was fleeing Jerusalem? Someone comes and just screaming at him and fussing at him. And just, you can just see him. That's kind of what, And as Shimei is going through all of that, people say, let me shut him up. David says, no. And Shimei now comes saying, please forgive me. I shouldn't have done that. And David says, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. And again, we have to remember, some of the connections and things that are going on as we think about David's commitment to Mephibosheth, as we look at this unfolding. In chapter 19, there are several things that happen in that connection as he remembers his promises to Mephibosheth, though remember Mephibosheth stayed back in Jerusalem. And so now that land that he'd given Mephibosheth, he took it and divided it between him and the individual who was given the task of taking care of Mephibosheth. And so there's a lot of details being unwound here. And as we think about the familial connections, it's all value. But fundamentally, at its core, it seems to me, because you know, wrestling through all of those details are fascinating to me. But the thing I have to keep in my mind as we go through this is someone is coming. God has a plan. And through all of this, through the seed of David, someone's going to sit on a throne and reign in a kingdom that will last forever and ever and ever. And because of God's plan, you and I can be part of that kingdom. And so as we look at even all of these details and appreciate how things are intertwined, it's not a whole lot unlike government today, is it? Why is he doing this for this one and this for this one? Oh. Or we find in some corporate setting that there's some political machinations going on. As, well, how'd he get that job? Oh. Why'd she get... Oh, I didn't know that. I mean, a lot of this is still going. How did Solomon put it in Ecclesiastes? Nothing new under the sun. And so as we look at all of the things that are going on behind the scenes in David's rule, some of that is certainly God's unfolding, and some of it's just, I'm sorry, but it just seems to me like the same old we see today in regards to how people rule and reign and manage things when they're in positions of authority. And like I say, particularly from Joab's standpoint, as we looked at all of that, you know, just, when all was said and done, yes, he served David. Yes, he was going to protect David. He was going to fight for David. But when all is said and done, it looks to me like he was doing it for Joab. It looks to me like that was his primary thrust. The Bible does not indicate it. That's just a conclusion I'm coming to. And there would be people that would take another side of that, and that's fine. The point is, God has a plan. And and what God said through how 2 Samuel is divided up back in chapter 17 is it's time for Absalom to go. Circumstances are going to evolve and come about. And Absalom needs to get taken out of the way. David is the one who needs to be ruling over Israel at this point in time, and that's where God's headed. Questions you have, comments?
You know, leadership is kind of a tricky situation because as men, you make a decision without the benefit of knowing what the outcome of that decision is going to be, the consequences of that decision is going to be. Mm-hmm. You make a decision and you play it out in your mind, and you hope that the outcome is the way it's played out in your mind. A lot of times it's not. But God has the ability to be able to take a bad decision
and I would say this even in regards to the concept of God manipulating that. When we go back and we look at the events back in the book of Exodus, and we look at what was going on with Pharaoh. Well, it tells us from two or three different ways. How did God harden Pharaoh's heart? Did Pharaoh harden Pharaoh's heart? And so we see that going on. So even as we think about that, we need to understand that what is impacting people is, here's truth. And you make a choice. You make a decision about that. And at some level, at some point, we may ignore truth as we make decisions. And it may be a truth we weren't aware of, due to a lack of study, a lack of maturity, a lack of ability to perceive. But nevertheless, we do need to understand that God is able and will, without question, accomplish His purposes. And He accomplishes that with truth. Jesus presents truth. I am the truth. Now you make a choice. And the person who chooses something other than Jesus, well, there are going to be some consequences with that. Ring the bell if you, I mean, what time are you supposed to do it? I don't know. Okay. But, yes, sir.
Humility has a lot to do with making the right choice sometimes, too.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's, and there are times when making the right choice takes a little longer than we want it to. We want to do something now. And there are times that God tells us, wait. There were times Moses really said, now you wait and I'll show you how this is going to unfold. Questions on chapter 18, we'll let Leon take care of those next time, or whoever will be teaching next Sunday morning, and